this philosophy is so dangerous. You know, we must, that's why she said she had to sentence him to 3 life sentences to make sure that no one dare take up his flag, she said. And that flag is the anarchist flag. It was an agorist flag, even more specifically. It was the idea of creating systems now that serve the people and routing around them entirely, not thinking that violence is the answer, that voting is the answer, but really trying to just create and build.
You're listening to The Corbett Report.
Welcome, friends. James Corbett here, CorbettReport.com, April 17th, 2017, and today we're delighted to have back on the program Derek Brose of theconscienceresistance.com that you should probably know by now because we've talked to him several times, but if you haven't heard those interviews yet, you should definitely at least go back and listen to interview 1103, where we talked to Derek about agorism and counter-economics, a very important conversation and one that has a lot of relevance to what we're going to be talking about today, namely the brand new offering from not only Derek Brose, but his collaborator John Vibes, who have just created a brand new book called Manifesto of the Free Humans, which, for those of you keeping track at home, is part 3 of the Conscious Resistance trilogy of books by John Vibes and Derek Brose. Derek, thanks for joining us again on the program.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, James, for having me back on.
All right, Manifesto of the Free Humans. First of all, we should note that it is a free download available from your website, so we'll put the link in for people to go and download it. Of course, they can also buy a copy from CreateSpace, but let's unpack this a little bit. Manifesto of the Free Humans, that is a pretty tall order and sounds a little bit like herding cats to me. What do you mean by that?
So yeah, the title, obviously it's a big part of writing any book. You know, this is the first thing people, they look at, they kind of judge it based on that, and of course the cover. And John and I, after writing the first two books in the series, which in the beginning we didn't even know we were going to write a trilogy, it just sort of evolved this way. We thought of the idea of calling it the agorist manifesto, because it's, as you said, counter-economics and agorism is a huge part of the conversation. But really we wanted something that could be, it could just catch people's attention. You know, obviously if people don't know what agorism is, they're just going to be like, what does that even mean? I don't even know. And maybe they won't go further than that. And also in our first book, I was looking back through it and I realized that we'd used this phrase free humans a couple of times. That it just was part of the writing that, you know, when we were talking about individuals, you know, we're trying to think of how to say this, and sometimes it would just come out as free human beings. You know, that's what we really are. Despite any divisions of color or politics or nationality, we are at the heart of it sovereign, free human beings, if we choose to be. And that was what we're trying to go for, is to get that message across. And of course, Manifesto really says something like, hey, this is going to be a powerful message. This is going to be a tool for you. And that's really what we're going for, is trying to create something that could be a tool, a guide to free humans around the world.
Well, going off of our conversation last time on agorism and what that is, of course, is the combination of philosophy, the idea behind what it means to be free and live in a free world, but also the action is the other side of it. And I think that comes through in this book, that it's really the two parts that make the whole. So let's take a look at those two parts independently first. You talk about a lot of the philosophical progenitors of the libertarian philosophy in the American context, at any rate, going back to the Boston anarchists. You talk about more recent authors as well. Tell us a little bit about the philosophical pedigree of the ideas expressed in this book.
Absolutely. So we wanted to make it, it's divided into three parts, first of all. So the first part really does focus on that, looking at the philosophy and the history of the American individualist movement, you know, what is now known pretty much as the libertarian movement in America. We wanted to look at that to establish, like, here's the people, here are the ideas that we have learned from. In the past two books, we've mentioned, you know, Murray Rothbard. We've talked about other anarchist philosophers, including some who would be considered on the left, Proudhon and Kropotkin and others like that. But we wanted to establish, this is the kind of lineage where we think our ideas are picking up from. In a lot of ways, we are influenced somewhat by Murray Rothbard and his ideas in the 60s and such, but there's also a lot of the ideas that predate him. And to that point, I think there's lots of modern American anarchists, American libertarians, who are lacking in a historical context of where these movements come from. And we wanted to really put that out there. So we talk about Josiah Warren specifically. He's definitely somebody that's very important in my research. I read a book called Men Against the State, which I highly recommend to anybody who's a student of history, especially American history, American anarchist history. You really get this sense of, wow, at the same time of the American Revolutionary War, Constitutional era leading up to the Civil War, despite all the founding fathers they tell you about who were trying to use the state in one form or another, there were these other individuals who were propagating a message of true freedom and of trying to create an anarchist society. And Josiah Warren was one of those people, but he was also not just a theorist, but an actual creator of these communities. And that's what I love about him. I mean, he's got these books that are literally diaries of years of what they did in these communities, how it went about, what succeeded, how they dealt with, you know, bad elements within the community. And a lot of these ideas and things that he's already written about that happened in the 1800s are ideas that anarchists today in America talk about theoretically, like, well, this is what we'll do in the future. This is what we'll do. And I've realized, I'm like, wow, well, we have somebody, a historical example of somebody who had a community of thousands of people with no cops, no court, no jails, and they, you know, dealt with people by excommunication, stopped doing business with people that were unfavorable, different things like this. These ideas that, again, we talk about in theory, we can look and see. And they didn't fail. They weren't, you know, they didn't, these ideas didn't go anywhere. They just kind of got swallowed up and incorporated into the state, unfortunately. So we're trying to take the history and the knowledge that Josiah Warren and others have really put out there, bring that up to the modern age with the technology that we have now, cryptocurrency, decentralized peer-to-peer platforms, the internet itself, and say, let's learn from those who've done this in the past, who set up intentional anarchist communities. Because a lot of the communities that were established in colonial pioneer days in America were based on religion. They were one of the first exclusive intentional communities that was not based on religion or anything like that. It was based on his principle, sovereignty of the individual, that we elaborate upon in the book. So we wanted to talk about that. We wanted to show how that influenced Rothbard and, of course, Samuel Konkin, who is the founder of Agorism, and then take those ideas after kind of putting a bit of philosophy, a bit of history, bring them up to how it's happening now. And we really attempted to, and I think we successfully did, expand upon those ideas and make them a little bit more modern for those who are trying to find freedom right now.
That's right. And as I say, again, this book combines not just the philosophy, but the action. And you talk about Josiah Warren and his creation of intentional communities back in the 19th century. But there's more recent examples that you point to as well. People like Ross Ulbricht and Daryl Davis. Can you tell us about some of those more recent examples?
Absolutely. Yeah, these are great examples. You know, of course, we're talking about creating a potentially free society and using agorism, counter-economics, the black and gray markets, exploiting that economic power, siphoning economic power away from the state. When we talk about these ideas, we want to put it into the context of how the state deals with this. And one of the greatest examples is Ross Ulbricht, who is, of course, the accused founder of the Silk Road marketplace, online marketplace, who is currently serving 3 life sentences behind bars for creating a website and for allowing free people to come together without the statist interference. And even when you go back to the old Silk Road website, Dread Pirate Roberts, the admin, and Ross Ulbricht in his personal writings have both expressed an affinity and an interest for agorist ideas and said that this is an economic experiment. This is trying to show people what business can be like without the state involved. And I was at the trial of his sentencing, and in the trial, the judge straight up says, this philosophy is so dangerous, you know, we must, that's why she said she had to sentence him to 3 life sentences to make sure that no one dare take up his flag, she said. And that flag is the anarchist flag. It was an agorist flag, even more specifically. It was the idea of creating systems now that serve the people and routing around them entirely, not thinking that violence is the answer, that voting is the answer, but really trying to just create and build. So we talk about, we of course have to reference Ross and put it in the context of what Konkin talked about in his 4 stages of moving from statism to agorism. And he said, at one point he mentions, you know, if any sort of inspirational or, you know, eager agorist move too quickly while the counter economy hasn't been established and while I think the Freedom Cell Network hasn't been established, the state will crush you. And that's what happened is, unfortunately, people like Ross and others who are kind of pioneering on this front, they are the first ones, and we see how the state works. But the ground that they're laying, the paths that they're, the trails that they're blazing are going to help agorists in the future, you know, and they already are today. And then Daryl Davis is just another brilliant example of strategy and how to use this, particularly right now. I think this is way current because we're dealing with, this is the day after the Berkeley riots, you know, Antifa and alt-right people beating each other up in the streets. And I don't know what sort of solutions they think that they're getting out of this. But ultimately, these sides, these extreme sides in America and really around the world are being engineered. There's social engineering going on to divide people. And these individuals think that it's not worth their time to communicate. They would rather well, these are my opponents. The only way to communicate with them is through violence. Let me just beat them up. Let me just punch Richard Spencer in the face. And this is, I'm not sitting here defending any of these ideas. I really don't find much to agree with on either extreme side. But at the same time, what we're pointing out in the book is there are beautiful, powerful examples of people like Daryl Davis, who's a black man, jazz musician, went out there speaking directly to KKK members, people who hated him, who want to say they want to string his people up in trees and things like that, and decided to use essentially nonviolent communication tactics and just go there and connect with people. He said he would try to go play pool with them or talk to them about music, just to find some way to connect to them on a human level. And he's had over 200 Klan members quit the Klan, give them their hood and everything, and even a police officer who was part of the Klan and the police give him his police uniform and his KKK uniform. And he's just a great example of somebody who just tried to find that human connection. And we bring that up in reference to the second part of the book, which goes into, okay, let's start getting to some of the conflicts. We talk about the environment. We talk about the authoritarian right and left and property, of course, a hugely divisive issue, and saying, like, how can we realistically come up with solutions that don't include having to fit everybody into one single box? You're an ANCAP, you're an ANCOM, you're this or that, which to me is just unrealistic to expect that everybody is going to adopt one single philosophy, so we try to use him an example of that, of nonviolent communication, of trying to come across to individuals, and it's been obviously very effective. I would say a punch to the face, that making people afraid, trying to put them into fear so they drop their bad ideas, it doesn't work. It's just, fear is not a very good motivator. It's only a motivator to a certain degree, whereas connecting with somebody, getting them to see you on a human level, has so much power to it. And I really think those are the kind of solutions we're putting forth.
Well, I wholeheartedly second that, and especially in the current political and social climate, as you point out. And you don't shy away from the hot-button topics in this book, because there certainly are some that go around, even in the so-called erstwhile anarchist or freedom-oriented circles. It's certainly become more and more divisive in recent years, especially around subjects like immigration, which you address in the book. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's always a fun one, because like you said, it's a hot-button issue. These are the issues that bringing them up will either, cause an outright argument. We can throw abortion in there, we can throw borders, immigration. These are the kind of things that people generally go straight to that emotional state, the fight or flight, where it's difficult to actually have communication because they react emotionally. Maybe they have a friend who's an immigrant, so they're dealing with this situation, or somebody's like, well, I know somebody who was killed by an immigrant, so there's a lot of emotion on both sides. And again, we tried to cut through that and look at this from a logical perspective, and again, a perspective that doesn't say we all need to fit into one box. I don't expect that our answers are going to satisfy everyone in these debates. That's impossible, so we're fine with that. But we wanted to come out finally, as the last two books, we've talked about these issues a little bit, referenced them, but this was like, here we stand on this. And a big theme of the book is decentralization. Obviously, decentralizing from the state when it comes to our money, food production systems, the media. And we name this concept what we call decentralized borders. I think that what we're arguing is that the language is messed up, as well, because the property argument and the borders issue, immigration, they're all sort of tied in certain ways. Specifically, when it comes to immigration, we take this agorist approach of trying to say that if you look at immigrants around the world, especially illegal immigrants, and I don't really, even like that term, but illegal immigrants in the term of the state viewing them as not coming in legally, they are naturally going into the counter economy, the informal economy, whatever name you want to give it, because they work under the table. So there's a whole swath of the population who are potential agorists. Now, the right-leaning individuals will say, no, well, the left and the immigrants and these liberals, they're more likely to come in and vote for the state, and so the state grows through that. And, I'm not going to necessarily disagree. That does seem to be the case. Some people will come in and they want to get benefits from the state, but perhaps that's only for lack of trying. Perhaps we haven't put enough effort. Maybe there needs to be, as we suggest in the book, an organized effort of agorists to go educate them and say, no, you may think that this dollar is freedom, but let us tell you about the Federal Reserve. Let us tell you about this. I mean, this is why it's so great that a lot of your work is translated into several different languages, and that's what we're working on next with our books, is because we want this message to be global. If you're ever going to have an effect, you got to get past just the English speakers, and once individuals who are coming into the U.S. or any other nation, and they already got this agorist philosophy, or maybe some groups of people come to welcome in, you know, a role of the Freedom Cells could be like a welcoming committee. Welcome to the U.S. You know, we're not going to ask questions about how you got here. We'd like to help you out a little bit and give you some information. Show you here's opportunities for black and gray market activity. Here's why you don't want to do that. You know the crises you're running from that our country caused. Well, the more you use their money, the more you get into their tax system, the more you support those things. So let us show you other opportunities. And this is backed up by evidence and research from a book called The Other Path, which is a really great book. It definitely wasn't intended to be an agorist research, I think, but I started reading it because it's all about the global counter economy, specifically in Peru in the 70s and 80s. And briefly, in that time, there was a terrorist group, the Maoist terrorist group called the Shining Path, that was teaching, you know, the peasant class needs to rise up and the market's the problem and all this kind of stuff. So the Institute for Democracy or something like that, they basically created this book called The Other Path, which put out a message that immigrants and the peasant class actually want to be a part of the market. You know, they actually want to thrive and to be entrepreneurs. And this is based off their research showing that once the terrorists came in and started committing all the crimes, the people ran to the countryside, not only to escape the terrorists, but to escape regulation. You know, they talk about examples how somebody trying to get a sewing license in Peru at that time would take about 3 years just to get the proper license to, you know, for the first step. And it could take up to 10 years. So obviously there's these barriers to entry for people who want to become entrepreneurs. They decided to say, screw it. They went to the countryside. They built shanty towns. They started, you know, pre-Uber, pre-Lyft, little ride-sharing services with carts and stuff, and had open markets. And they did it without licenses. And they specifically, when interviewed and talked about, said, we're doing this to escape the regulation. We're doing this to escape the taxes. So, I mean, right there is evidence that people coming from other places will eventually get sick and tired of the state and its taxation, and if possible, will go and just form their own. So in the book, they call it the informal economy. There's a lot of statistics, and we reference that in there about how big the global informal or counter economy is. With the immigration issue, that's what we're saying, is maybe as aware, conscious agorists, as we've talked about in the past, James, some people can be practicing counter economics, but not necessarily be fully aware of the philosophy behind it. So it's going to take, you know, a cadre, a group of freedom cells of individuals going out there to immigrant communities and making that effort. I think it's a valuable effort. And then how that ties to the borders, we are saying that the language is all wrong. We're talking about public versus private property when it's all statist. You know, I mean, it's really hard to say something's public because people in their minds, they think, oh, people, us, that's ours, you know, but it's really it's owned by the state, you know, and then we have obviously private property with the state doesn't really exist so much because if they want to use eminent domain, they'll come in there. So we're trying to say that the language we're using, it's part of the problem. It's faulty. You know, a lot of it, we try to address the semantics of the issues, and that's the unfortunate part. There's so many people that like capitalism, oh, or communism, you know, there's all these triggering words that people can't even get beyond. We try to cut through that and call for a decentralized border. And again, say that with technology, we're probably the concepts of property and borders and these things that we're going to see in the future are probably beyond anything we can imagine now, especially as blockchain technology gets used in new ways beyond just cryptocurrency and other technologies that are coming. It's difficult for me to imagine that the concepts of private or property that we have now and these ideas are just going to stay static. So we're trying to put forth something that can reach many people, can come up with some solutions. And as I said, it's not going to satisfy everyone. But I think in a true spontaneous order, a true stateless society, we're going to see situations play out different. It's not always going to be a strictly ANCAP system or a strictly anarcho-communist system. It's going to be actual spontaneous order. And so one community might say, you know what, let's try this. Let's do this differently. Let's try this way. And then all of a sudden a new form or a new concept of property or borders are imagined. So we're trying to push into that area.
Well, Derek, one of the things that really struck me about the book was that it seemed a repeating theme of the book's message that, yes, it is often so much a question of the language that is employed to describe things that can lead us astray. And you point to that over and over again. For example, you write, freedom cells could be seen as a very specific type of mutual aid group where agorism and counter-economics play a key role. The name comes as a response to state propaganda around terror cells, where we are consciously choosing to reclaim the language and build cells that spread freedom. Or you write, for example, the word democracy is used to make our oppressive political system seem more benevolent and legitimate, while the term capitalism is used to give the impression that we operate under a free market economy. Neither are true. To those who would say the problem is a misunderstanding of capitalism, we wish to re-emphasize that capitalism, socialism, and communism have all been associated with statism and authoritarianism. This is an extremely important point, especially considering the fact that so many anarchists are attached to one of these terms. Some are attached to the term socialism because they align with the stated goals of socialism, such as ending poverty. Meanwhile, others are attached to the term capitalism because they align with its stated goals of free enterprise and private property. However, with both of these systems, the stated goals are vastly different from the ends they achieve. For this reason and many others, these terms should be abandoned when discussing future concepts of non-statist economic systems. You also, for example, as you point out, point to the open-closed border debate and how that's the language itself shapes our thinking around it, when we could alter that by using a term like decentralized borders to try to come at more what an anarchist position would be. Can you talk about this problem of how language is used as one of the tools of the oppressor?
Yeah, absolutely. And we did really try to reemphasize this. And this is a problem, an issue I run into often, for example, on social media. I have a following that includes hardcore anarchists, people really up to date with philosophy. They're just as nerdy for the philosophy as John and I. And then there's others who just get the message of freedom, and they kind of hear these names here and there, but they're not going to go read these books. They're not in the ANCOM versus the ANCAP debate groups, you know. So to them, they're kind of like, why are you guys using so many labels? Or can't we all just be free humans? Or, you know, this kind of thing. And obviously words have meaning. You know, we know that we can attach meaning to words, and we can try to find common ground. It's the goal of the Orwellians to corrupt language and to make it really wishy-washy and hard to decipher so that it can be used for anything. And we do try to avoid that arbitrariness, because that's a problem as well. But the difficulty is when I can post on social media and say, what does capitalism mean to you, and get 100 different definitions from people, that perfectly shows you why there's a problem trying to communicate to people. Because it's like you have to start first, okay, let's define all of our terms before we go any further. How do you define this, and how do you define this? And then you can see where the real differences are. Obviously, that's not the approach most people take. It's kind of tedious. So they're arguing based on assumptions often. Like, I'm going to assume he either thinks the same thing I have, and then we come at each other with these ad hominems, and it's just on and on and on. I do think that division helps the oppressors in the long run. But again, words have meaning. We should strive to find and understand them. But as you just pointed out, there's really no reason to cling to words that are going to trigger people and set them off. And I know people could say the same thing. Well, what about anarchism? Anarchism has these negative associations. I understand that. But there's never been an anarchist state. You know, some people may try to call themselves anarchists, but if they're trying to create a state, they're not anarchist. I'll just say that. Despite the sort of mainstream distraction by calling anarchism chaos, generally, and I think with the help of these movements, we're getting people to understand that it doesn't mean throwing bricks through windows. It doesn't mean violence in the streets. It means free people coming together and building gardens and seeking solutions and creating alternatives. That's what anarchism is about. And I look through the history and I look at this idea that's so pure. And again, though, I'm not really even concerned if people call themselves anarchists. I can find ways to communicate the message to them without even using any of those words. I can sit there and ask them, well, do you think it's wrong to use violence against another person? Okay, you don't. Well, do you think it's wrong if a group of people get together and say that, you know, they have the right to use violence? And sort of break down the issues and get these people to understand without having to really dive into that whole, you know, that whole discussion. So when people come to me and say, Derek, why are you guys so stuck to these labels? I don't even know what half those words mean. You know, I just don't like the current system. And so we're also turning off a whole group of people who aren't interested. And they're like, you know, people just get like a knee jerk reaction. And I understand, like, I don't really like to wear labels if forced to. Yes, I'm an agorist. That's the tactics I choose. You know, I'm an anarchist. You could push me to say that. But at the end of the day, I'm a free human, you know, and this is the goal of it. We're all free humans, right? So let's find a way to get past the divisive language, get past these wedge issues, these hot button issues, and find the common ground that I know exists, that it does exist, and focus on that, you know. And because otherwise we do see that the division taking place in the country, it's people over arguing over semantics. You know, they're, you're a fascist, you're a racist, you're anti-American. And a lot of times I've found, I remember going to the RNC last year when Trump was first rising and seeing the Trump and Antifa people fighting then and trying to mediate between them and helping these two guys come to a point where they realize, okay, we both don't like America right now. We're both unsatisfied. We're just going about it differently, you know? And even that was like, they had difficulty admitting. They didn't even want to admit that there was something they could agree upon, you know? And at that point, it's like, we're just dealing with people who are afraid to be wrong. And that's a whole nother issue. But as far as getting them to the core of like, look, we both have issues. We all have problems here. Maybe we diverge on the solutions, but let's focus on the common ground that we have and work from there. You know, and yes, there probably will be some breaking points at some point in the future. But all we're doing now by focusing on theoretical economic systems in the future and fighting over these semantic arguments, we're just dividing ourselves further. We're wasting time and energy. You know, I just posted on Facebook earlier, you can't pay me to go waste my time, energy, and money to document a report on these Antifa versus alt-right fights. I'm not going to sit around and chase some idiots around for 5 hours just so people can see some drama. Like, I could spend 5 hours like I did today building in my community garden and, you know, creating community, actually giving people answers. And that's what I think clear language, clear communication, compassionate communication, empathy, just being, you know, empathetic towards another human being. Those things lend themselves towards solutions. Whereas spending all day debating on Facebook, spending hours and hours, you know, wasting your time essentially, especially if nobody's gaining, if no one's budging and it's just raging against each other, you're getting nowhere. You know, we're letting ourselves be lost in these semantic arguments.
Well, speaking of real solutions, rather than just wasting time in needless debate, as the title might suggest, Manifesto of the Free Humans, this is a manifesto towards what is a project of sorts that you have planned over the next few years, the creation of an intentional community. Tell us about what community you're going to be creating and what it's going to look like.
Absolutely. This is definitely, for me, one of the most exciting aspects of the book, getting this idea out there, because I floated it out last year. I put out a video saying, you know, I have an intention for an intentional community sometime in the coming years. And then when John and I started working on the book, which, by the way, this book was written in 7 days. John lives in the woods in Maryland, and I flew up there from Houston. We sat in his cabin in the woods for 10 to 12 hours for 7 days straight and just knocked it out. We wanted to have no other distractions. So I really feel like we got our most clear-headed thinking out of this. And in the process of those conversations, the freedom cells, agorism, all these things that we touch on in the book, we really, okay, where are we going? Where is the point of this? You know, Kant can describe these stages. Where are we at today? How can we help people move through those stages? Trying to give real world tools and ideas on these solutions and these ideas. For me, it's inevitable that when I look around, like, I need to go to somewhere that I can live as close in line with my values as possible. This mainstream, deadstream world, Babylon, whatever people want to call it, it does not represent the values I stand for. And it's very difficult for me, and this is, again, a personal choice. It's not a judgment on the way anybody else chooses to live. It's very difficult for me to keep working within these systems and using their products and just having to play that game. Even though I have a very decentralized life, I'm a journalist, so I don't have to be on anybody else's schedule. I do what I want when I want. I still recognize that within the cityscape, there's only so much I can do. So the goal we have is in the Freethinker house where I'm living now, we use this as the hub for the Freedom Cell, that, like we've talked about on the Freedom Cell interview. And we're using this to awaken people from the city, spread our propaganda, get them active, get them involved in solutions. Now, as this grows, the plan that we put out in the book is to launch this intentional community somewhere in Texas, ideally by 2020, with all the concepts that are laid out in the book. We also have a couple illustrations in the book that there's one that's like the triangle of liberation is kind of what I've been calling it. And it's this 3-point triangle that illustrates the points that we're trying to put into effect with the community, which would be the sovereignty of the individual. Some people call it the non-aggression principle, very similar. Another corner is mindfulness, which again is compassionate communication, nonviolent communication, maybe some form of meditation or group communication. These ideas that can help us cultivate an empowered self as much as an aware self in the physical world. You know, a big part of our message in books has been that in order to truly create this vision we're talking about, we're going to need these levels of communication. We're going to need some self-work and some self-healing, individual healing, because that's the reason people are going to fight each other in the street. They're lashing out like children who still haven't got over whatever wound they're suffering from, and that allows them to be very manipulated. So mindfulness is a big part of this. And then the third corner is Permagora, which is I got from another guy named Eric McCool, really awesome permaculture farmer in Oregon, who also happened to be an agorist and said, you know, these ideas go great together, you know. So permaculture is, of course, got its own set of principles, and it's just trying to take the non-aggression principle to agree and applying it to the way we do agriculture, the way that we grow our food, and being constructive rather than invasive and destructive, building systems that encourage more life and, you know, not just poison the weeds with pesticides, but put crops that allow the deer to come eat and allow the birds and the bees and the pollinators. So all of those things combined with the counter-economic strategy and the agorist philosophy go towards what we call the conscious agora, this ideal community that we're working towards. So we're going to spend the next couple of years touring to promote the book and the message, and also building the Freedom Cell Network. I mean, I, since the book released last week in Philadelphia, I've already had several people say that they've met people through it, and I got to speak at Anarchapulco and in Philadelphia, telling people, please pull out your phones right now, join the Freedom Cell Network. So we're already seeing the growth of it and encouraging them, reminding, like, this isn't just another social network to go meet. This is to connect with people in the real world and to start building these ideas. So that's what we're going to be doing for the next couple of years. And then the reason I chose 2020, besides giving ourselves some space to really establish this, is because I want to make it clear the next time Americans are electing a new president or reelecting Donald Trump, that when they find themselves spending and expending energy and time and effort on that game, we're going to say, all right, well, we're launching our community. You vote for your president and you see how the next 4 years work for you. And we're going to build for 4 years too. And at the end of that, we'll see who has produced more freedom, more value, more community, more solutions. And I'm very confident in our ability to do just that. So that's really where we're headed with this whole project. And I just want to mention this because I know there will probably be a comment or two about it. But what about property taxes, right? This is obviously an issue. This is where we have to kind of just yield to the state for a moment, because they have the control. This is the final stage, right? We can take away the income tax. We can take away sales tax by producing our own goods and not giving them as little money as possible. But if we want land, if we actually want to put these ideas, as I said, I want to create what I want, my values, my principles. I want to feel good about the food I eat and the systems I'm producing and contributing to. I don't want to feel guilty every day or just feel like I'm working to enslave myself. In order to do that, I have to concede for a moment that we're going to have to pay property taxes, yes. But I do believe and I do hope that as this movement grows and as we spread this word and as Konkin predicted, and the counter economy grows and the status unsustainable system shrinks and then inevitably, you know, tries to lash out at the people, if we're able to build enough of this Freedom Cell Network and these support groups and mutual aid groups, we will get to a point where we can defend our own communities and decide, you know what, this year they don't have enough power. We can do it. Let's go ahead. Let's stop. Let's not pay property taxes this year. And, you know, that leads to all other discussions and possible future situations and scenarios. But we really want to push into that. I don't want to just sit here and talk about it, because that's the reality one way or the other is, you know, some people are saying, well, what about Waco, right? They're going to turn you into Waco. What are you guys going to do? How are you going to defend your community? I've even seen this on our interviews. They're like, oh, that's all well and good until the state comes in. And I'll say this without saying too much. You'd be a fool to think that we weren't prepared to defend ourselves or that we haven't thought of those things as well. You know, we're doing things on a regular basis through our Freedom Cell. Next weekend, we have a self-defense skill share. You know, there's things like that we are keeping in mind. And you better believe that if we decide to get land and invest money and time and energy into a community, that we would be prepared to defend that community against any kind of criminal, common criminal, status criminal, or other. And I'm not calling for a Waco situation. I'm just saying to think that we're just going to go sit out there like sitting ducks waiting for the state to come get us is just a little silly. So we're aware. I know it sucks. I don't want to pay property taxes. I give them as little as my money as possible. But if I can pay them that tiny chunk for now while we build something that's going to really change the future, I believe, then I'll do that. And I do believe that we will get to the point where we're strong enough and they're weak enough to say we're not doing it anymore.
Right. Well, it's also particularly amusing, I suppose, that the people who would make such comments are the people who are themselves paying property tax and existing in the system and doing all of this. They are the sitting, they're not even sitting ducks or whatever. They're willing participant ducks in the system. but how dare you even think about trying to do something different? Well, I think it's very exciting, very interesting to hear about. Obviously, people want to know more, so they can go to the consciousresistance.com and download the book for free and or purchase a copy and read more about it. But not only that, people who are existing in the geographical space governed by the tyrants of the U.S. government have the privilege of meeting you on your U.S. tour that you're doing this summer. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this aspect because, as I was saying a moment ago, this message is something that needs to be brought to the people. It's not enough to just put the book out. They're like, all right, well, we're done. We contributed to human society. Hopefully they discover the ideas. I want to get out there on the ground level and meet people and talk to people, especially because since our interviews and other videos I've done about Freedom Cells, I've had people reach out for me all over the world and say, hey, we're already doing this. We call it this group or we call it this name, you know. So the time seems to be ripe for it. People are really, really open to it. I just spoke 2 days at an unschooling peaceful parenting community that was totally open to this idea. I was like, wow, like we can use this. We're already doing this, you know. So our goal is to go out and travel the U.S. We're doing 46 cities starting in June 1st. We're doing about 8 cities across Texas. And then we're going to head West Coast, go West Coast, Midwest, hit all the big cities. We're actually even being able to time it where we're going to be speaking at a couple of festivals that people have got us into. So our message might even go to a much wider, not even just an anarchist libertarian audience, but totally people who are totally new to these concepts. I'm really excited about that. And then we'll be hitting the East Coast in October. So all the details and everything for as far as the dates can be found at theconsciousresistance.com/tour. But what I'm most excited about is I didn't want to just do a tour that's like, hey, we have a new book, come pay attention to us. We got all the answers and, you know, we're magic and you're the audience. I wanted this participation aspect of it. And for that, we decided to do these action days, which I took inspiration from. There's a DJ or a producer that calls himself Polish Ambassador, and he's very much about permaculture and contributes this way. So when he does music tours, he does action days. So during the day before his show at night, he'll go do some type of community garden activity or some kind of volunteerism in the community. So again, it's taking the volunteerist ideals and putting them into practice. So every city that we visit before the actual evening event, we're going to be going to community gardens to volunteer or building new community gardens. We're going to be doing park cleanups, homeless outreach. I mean, the people who have been helping us in these different cities are really great people just volunteering. And I'm so excited because some of the stops, because our message is so diverse, it's anarchism, but it's also a bit spiritual and self-awareness. We're going to be speaking at yoga studios, meditation centers, backyards, bar and grills, bookstores, you know, pretty much anywhere that people can have us, we're willing to do that. Some universities, I think we're going to get to speak at as well. And as I mentioned, festivals, but we're going to be able to do all these different types of activities, actually giving back to the community and encouraging people. Maybe they're only coming to these activities because they know me or they know John or they know, you know, about the tour. And then all of a sudden they find themselves meeting other people in their community who are regularly volunteering, and that leads to new things. So it's going to spur all types of action and cross-pollination. And we'll be able to end this tour and say, we just contributed to 46 different cities. We built this amount of gardens. We did this amount of things. We're also going to be planting fruit trees along the way, just kind of guerrilla fruit tree planting. And then on the night events, it'll be like I'm going to open up with about a 10 to 15 minute meditation and then do talks about Freedom Cells, the books, where I'll go even more in depth in the concepts in the book. And John, my co-author, he's actually currently battling lymphoma right now without the help of chemo, doing CBD and all sorts of alternative therapies. And he's writing another book on that. If his health is well enough, he will be coming on the tour as well. And he does seem to be doing better day by day. So hopefully he'll be able to participate in as much of the tour as possible. And he'll talk about his battle with lymphoma as well. And my two housemates with the Freethinker House, they'll share their direct experience. This is what I've been doing. This is how I've learned. We've now got one of our housemates is about a week and a half away from quitting his day job and diving fully into the counter economy. And it's come through this house and through the Freedom Cells concept. So they're going to be able to say, this is what I'm doing. This is how I employ it. And then we're going to end with a little bit of music. They have a band together, so they're going to play some music. So it's going to be a combination of everything that the conscious resistance message is about, you know, spiritual empowerment and awareness, awareness of these philosophies that can lead us to more freedom, agorism, music, meditation, and community volunteering, volunteurist principles in action. So we're going to take all those ideas, cram them into 46 cities around the U.S., and people are asking us to come to Canada already, and I've got a few invites to come to Europe, so maybe by next year we'll be able to do that. My main goal is just to spend the next year to 2 years spreading this message and building Freedom Cells around the country so that the outcomes that we predict in this book and the intentional community that we're laying the groundwork for won't only be the only one, that eventually we're going to have a network of communities, and maybe people won't choose to go live in intentional communities. We address this in the book. Maybe you're a hermit, you want to live alone, or you just want to live with your family, but we can still have resources available for those who are ready to take action with them. There will be much more counter-economic activities and opportunities for individuals who pursue them. So I'm trying to do my work and dedicating my life and time to spreading this.
Excellent. Well, the thing that I like about your work is that you don't preach down to people and you're not telling people how to live and what they should do, what you do. That, again, comes across quite clearly in the book, that this is about the individual sovereignty and finding what that means for you. And, no, you don't have all the answers. I don't have all the answers. And yep. No one in the audience has all the answers, because we don't know how free, spontaneous societies will order themselves. But it is very fascinating to see this starting to come together. So I'm definitely going to be keeping my eye on it. Hopefully we'll get some updates from you as things continue to progress. But I think we'll leave it there for today. Derek Burrows, theconsciousresistance.com. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, James.
The Corbett Report is brought to you by you. Your support makes The Corbett Report possible. Sign up for the subscriber newsletter or purchase a DVD at corbettreport.com/support.